Good morning, church.
Good morning to you, too. It's good to see y'all this morning. Good to be together, as it always is this Sunday, this time on Sunday mornings. We have had a great study so far through the Ten Commandments, but before we get into that, I need to remind you that coming up, we have the parents' meeting. After our time worship together, and Mr. Morris is going to lead our prayer for the food so that you can just go over and get started. But I wanted to remind you, it is for the parents of kids who are in preschool up through sixth grade, but we want you to know it's not just for them. If you are the grandparents of kids who are preschool through sixth grade, or if you used to have kids who are preschool through sixth grade, if you maybe want to have kids who are going to be birthed through sixth grade one day, we want you to know that you're invited because we had such a good response last week. We have enough food that even if you didn't sign up, you can still come and eat, and it's barbecue, and it'll be good. So just come and join us for that time. So I'm going to try to be concise because we're mindful of that time that's coming up. I'm going to try to be really concise this morning. How many of you have seen the old Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston? Just raise them high. You were not watching that this morning. But near that movie, there's this scene where you have the Israelite men and women who were down at the base of Mount Sinai, and they've gathered up the gold, and they've made for themselves this golden calf. And it looks something like this. Oh, no, go back. There we go. Dadgummit. There it is. Okay, so there's the golden calf, and they're dancing around this, and they're about to make a human sacrifice in the movie. I don't know, it's not exactly from the text, but that's what they were doing in the movie. They were about to make this human sacrifice. And in this image right here is contrast kind of with what's going on with Moses, who is on the top of Mount Sinai, meeting with God. Moses, played by Charlton Heston, and then God, who is played by a pillar of fire, and God is going to set these Ten Commandments in stone. And so there you see Charlton Heston, he's right there, and that's God. He's coming from here and writing on the Ten Commandments right up there, okay, with something that I guess resembles a finger made out of fire. Anyway, so here's the thing. You've got God's voice booming from this pillar of fire on the top of Sinai. And he's saying, the first commandment is, you know, don't make an image of me to worship. Which is kind of ironic. Because the movie presents God as this pillar of fire, booming male voice. And I think that's an excellent example of why we should not try to make an image of God. Here he is. I mean, basically it's preaching that we shouldn't image of God by making an image of God. Isn't that ironic? But this has kind of always been one of our dilemmas, one of our problems. You see, we don't really know what to do with God. We're not sure what to make of God. And it's a problem that has faced the Israelites those thousands and thousands of years ago, and it still plagues us today. What are we supposed to do with God? What is our relationship with God supposed to look like? How is it supposed to manifest itself? So, now last week we examined the Ten Commandments, and we wanted to see how God used those to create for himself a united Israelite, a united Hebrew people out of these former Egyptian slaves, because like them, we wanted to be a united community of God's people. So we want to see how did God use those commandments to do that, because we want to do that. And so after going back over that, and I went back over my lesson, both I listened to it, and then I read one of my notes. I want to clarify that vision for us just a little bit. So I kind of reduced it. These are the three threads that seem to run throughout the Ten Commandments. And you may remember these three. But the first one was to love, serve, and worship the Lord. And that carries through the first of parts of the Ten Commandments. Then you've got some commandments that have deal with honoring and caring for your family. And finally, we have ensuring justice for really all of your fellow man. But we talked about how that was especially important for the weak because they were the most vulnerable. So this week, based on these, we're gonna kind of continue our study of the Ten Commandments by taking a look at this first part, how we're supposed to love and honor and worship and serve God. Because that's sort of where it all begins. And if you start off on a wrong foot there, if you start off with it slightly in the wrong direction, then all your steps sort of go awry. We have to get this first part down, or the rest of it doesn't really make sense. So it all begins with God saying this. Remember, we've read part of this before, but from Genesis. Who did that? It is Exodus, and I'm like 95% sure it's going to say Genesis the whole morning. Yes. I think it was autocorrect. Anyway, so it starts in Exodus chapter 22, where God says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land, or out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before. Maybe you have except me. Same idea. Now, all of you parents out there, you know how it is that we as parents sort of debate back and forth how we ought to be the authority figure versus how much we ought to be the close friend of our kids. And I don't mean either one of those in a negative way, because both extremes come with complications. An authority figure, while they are most definitely in charge, loses the closeness and the contact that a parent wants to have with their children. It loses out on being the one to whom your turns in times of crisis or times of joy, right? An authority figure hands down the law from on high, but doesn't get the relationship. On the other extreme, you have sort of the close friend who is granted all of the access to their child's world, but they lose the ability to be the voice of authority, especially in times of crisis, because their voice carries no more weight than any other close friend. Buddy, what do you do when the good buddy advice falls on deaf ears? So this is sort of the dilemma we as parents face. In theology, this is sort of the paradox of that's called transcendence and immanence. And what it is, a transcendent God is up on high. He's high above it. He's far removed from earthly influence, from being close with his creation. He just oversees it. He may oversees it, and God is not that intimately close with his creation. But on the other hand, you've got immanence where God is present. I mean, he is in every part and every particle and as close as the air we breathe and the blood in our veins. And here, in these two short verses that we read, we get that God is, I mean, we're communicated, we're told, God is both infinitely transcendent and infinitely immanent. He is both at the same time. Because God is immanent because he is with his people in Egyptian slavery. He hears their cries and delivers them. He is so close that he can respond to them. And yet, He is at the same time the Lord with the power to make all that possible. And this first commandment reinforces the transcendence of God, reminding the Israelites that there is no one else like God, and that nothing else must be considered in God's place or even alongside God, that he is at the top. He is the premier. So together with this introduction and this first commandment that we just read, it describes the God who is present and hears the cries of his people, but who cannot be manipulated by human will. And that's the real hook to this. God chooses to be present because he loves us, but we cannot force him to do anything any more than a really willful child, a hard-headed child, can force a good parent to bend to their will. Right? It's a parent who says, I will feed you and care for you because I love you, not because you're throwing a fit on the floor of Walmart. Right? I am the one who chooses to be present. You can't make me do what I do not will to do. So if we are truly, and this is coming up to us now, if we are truly a community of God, to recognize that the basis for us having a relationship with God at all is God's love on God's terms. That is the basis that He is the one who defines it. He's the one who started it. He's the one who not just initiated it, but created it and made it possible. He is the one who is close enough to do something for us. We can't do anything for God. And He's also the one who is the authority. He is the one in control. We are not the one who tells God what to do and when to do it. But we want it to be on our terms. I want God to do what I think is the right thing when I think it's the right time. And usually the right time happens to be right around now. We want God to sort of be at our beck and call, though we would never say it that way. I mean, that just sounds so disrespectful to say God ought to do what I think want Him to do when I think He ought to do it. We would never say it that way, but in our minds it sort of plays out that way. So much so that we're tempted sometimes to put God to the test. God, if You are really God, if You are really in control, and if You really love me, You need to do this. And we tell God what He needs to do. And so we're willing to bargain with God over who's really in control. And so this is what God says. Here's the second commandment, verses 4 through 6 of Genesis 20. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything, in heaven above, on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punish the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So, two quick things I want to take from this, and hopefully they will answer your questions, because this is it's a little bit of a controversial verse. First, this commandment becomes so important in the life of Israel that it becomes the barometer by which all of the kings of Israel will be measured. Every good king of Israel was the one who did not allow the proliferation and worship of idols. Every bad king was the one who allowed idol worship and allowed that. And that was the barometer that decided if you were a good king or a bad king. Did you allow this? Now, a lot of times what spilled over from idol worship was sexual immorality, and there was the way you treated poor people, and all that sort of spilled over. But it sort of began right there. That was it. So here's the takeaway. It doesn't matter how well-intentioned your images are. Notice what God says. We'll back up here to this end. Notice what God says here, that when you make an image, no matter what the image is, no matter what your intentions are, even if you make an image to worship God, God's saying, it's not me, it's them. Even if it's a good, a noble image, a holy image, a Christian image, no matter what it is you make, there's not a carving or a painting or a building or a government. If you build it and then you worship it, it's not me. Because you can't make me. If you build it and worship it, that's just a glorified way of honoring your own handiwork. You're not going to make a Christian building or a Christian piece of art or a Christian government. Of course, this was all pre-Christian. Today, in our language, we would say that. And then pay it honor. Because that's not me. You cannot architect and design me. Secondly, that's the first takeaway. Secondly, on the second half of this verse, we get this, and it sort of makes God, it can at least, make God out to be some unfair, unjust, and vindictive jerk. I mean, it can read that way. Punishing kids for the sins of their parents? I mean, if the law was to do that today, so just imagine this. If the Manchester City Police or the county sheriff or the state police came in and said, "You're under arrest and you're going to prison." You're like, "What did I do? What did I do?" Well, your parents stole. Would we say that was fair? No, certainly not. So why would God punish kids for the sins of parents? I mean, this is kind of a big question, at least it is in my mind. That just doesn't sound right. But in retrospect, I think even in our own experience, it's going to make sense. Let me explain to you how. How many of you and how many times have we seen families and individuals torn apart and lives destroyed generation after generation? If you have seen generational sin play out in your families or the families of others, just raise your hand. Addiction, lying, manipulation. And so it can all be traced back to an abusive and alcoholic grandfather, to a greedy and manipulative dad, to an unloving and adulterous mother. It all can be traced back because those sins do not confine themselves to one person. They affect generation after generation, sometimes after generation after generation. They play out. But more than that, I want to remember their culture. Remember that at that time, entire families lived together. So that if the patriarch, if the head of that family said, "I'm going to worship an idol, an image, I'm going to make something and we're going to worship it, it's going to be an image of Yahweh God or it's going to be an image of some other God, it doesn't really matter. If I'm going to make an image and I'm going to worship it, it's not a solo thing, it is a community of your family thing." So that if family was in that position and the patriarch said, "I'm going to do this," you have two choices. One, you report him, you turn him over to those in charge and say, "Look, this man, though we love him, he's our father, he's our grandfather, he's our great-grandfather, he has brought this into the home." You either turn him over or else you are a participant. And you're working, doing it right alongside. And in these households, it's not just parents and kids, it's three, sometimes four generations. Just like the third and fourth generation of those. So maybe what God is saying here is not that, you know, after you die, your kids are going to get it too. And after they die, their kids are going to do it. Maybe that's not what he's saying. Maybe he's just saying that your sin affects all of those around you. But rather than focus on the punishment, I want us instead to focus on the grace offered in obedience. 1,000 generations. Of grace. Now, three or four generations sounds harsh for punishment. It really does. But not when you stack it up next to 1,000 generations of grace. So all of that lets us know that the worship and service of God, that it requires a very personal, very intimate commitment, but it is a community affair. Like, it affects more than you. The way you worship and serve and love and honor God is not just a personal thing. It is a community thing. You know, whom and how you worship and serve God matters than more than just to you. It matters to your spouse. It matters to your kids. It matters to your parents, your brothers and sisters, and all of us. It matters to us whom and how you do that. Which is why I believe the final commandment we'll look at this morning matters so much, though it may not on the surface. You shall, the third commandment from Exodus 20, verse 7, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." Now, for those of you who are reading along your Bibles or on your phones or iPads, you may notice I switched over translations here. I usually use the NIV here, but the English Standard Version and even the King James Version is really a better on this because it talks about taking the name of God in vain versus misusing the name of the Lord. So what does it mean to take the name of the Lord in vain? What is that? To take a name in vain. So for much of my life, I'd have told you exactly what this was about. It's about cussing. Right? At least that's the way I understood it. You know, anytime you use God's name as an exclamation or, God forbid, as a curse, you were on really dangerous ground. That's the way I sort of understood the third commandment. Later in my life, I came to see it as a little bit bigger than that. Maybe a simple misusing God's name, which is why the NIV and some other translations will say that. Don't misuse the name of the Lord your God. So using the divine name Yahweh in an inappropriate way, like to gain power or influence over others, to make people do what you want or to make yourself look better than you are, all that is wrong use. And that, again, I think that's true. If I live a heathen life, but when I come around you, I start talking about Jesus and how gracious and merciful he is and how much I love him, that would be a wrong use of God's name. So, I think all of that is true. But to tell you the truth, now I think it's a lot bigger than that. Like much bigger. In fact, I don't think it has to do with speech, what you say at all. Though it includes it, this is not a speech commandment. The word that's translated take, do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That word take in its primary meaning is to take up, to lift up, or to carry. So in the story of Noah, remember the story of Noah? The waters came and they took up, lifted up, bore up the ark from Genesis chapter 7. Later in Genesis 29, Jacob lifted up his feet. All the same word. That's the same word it's used to describe carrying a baby or carrying laundry, like garments. It's used to describe carrying fruit. It's a lifting up and a carrying word. And then you tag onto that this Hebrew expression, in vain, which is a lot bigger than just the idea of a falsehood or a lie. It's not just to say God's name falsely or use it in a lying way. It's a lot bigger than that. It's the idea of emptiness or worthlessness or lack of reality. So put those together, and what God seems to be saying here to these people, these descendants of Abraham, is that they should not carry the name of their God in a careless or vain way. Or to put it more bluntly, don't be known as people unless you know what that means and agree to do it. Don't say that you are mine. Don't call yourself by my name unless you know what that means and are committed to do that. Taking up God's name is not just something you say, it is something you do. Taking up God's name is a life-changing reality, holding both the possibility to give life and to take our very lives. Brothers and sisters, we cannot call ourselves the people of God unless we put our money and our time and our energies and our efforts where our mouths are. You cannot say you're a Christian with your mouth and then not live it with your life. Otherwise, we are taking God's name in vain. And so when we put all this together, these first three commandments, we see God's ascendance, we see his imminence, we see his jealousy, we see the power of carrying his name, and we begin to understand what it means to be a community of that guy's people. What it means to be a community of that God's people. It is a solemn and a serious matter to claim that name, his name, and to say that we belong to him. I am a Welch. It's my last name, right? Dustin Welch. I know this. I've been taught this from a very early age, what it means to carry this name, my family's name. It means that I was never going to be a little guy or have tan skin or be a vegan. It was never going to happen. It means that I have Texas in my blood. It means to work hard and sacrifice for those we love. It means dedications to those who depend on us, maybe especially to our fellow Christians. I mean, I've been taught that from the earliest age, and no doubt family's name carries similar lines of significance, similar of meaning of what it means to be an Elrod, or what it means to be a Parker, or what it means to be Tommy. you know. So it provides us who we are. It provides us meaning and organization in a chaotic world so that we deal with the world in a particular way. So knowing what we know about Yahweh, what does it mean for us, the formal church of Christ, to be carrying God's name? What does it mean for us? What does it mean for us to be carrying, bearing up, taking up the name of God in this world today? It means, based on these commandments, it means, number one, that God is primary. Number two, that God is sovereign and in control. And number three, it means that God's name matters. So based on these ideas, these are our expectations, or ought to be our expectations, for one another in this community. Going to give you two expectations this morning, and if you that would be fantastic. Number one, we expect that when this community gathers to worship or to serve, to honor our Most High God, that you are a part of that. Not because God will punish you. That has nothing to do with why our expectations are that. We expect you to be a part of it because God is the most important thing to you, and you're willing to make sacrifices on His behalf because that's who you are. If my father, hospital, and they say, we're calling the family together, it is important to be together at your father's bedside at this particular time, I don't say, oh, I guess I'll have to take a day off. I mean, listen, that's important. Being there with your family at times of importance, that's a primary thing. That's who you are. So as a community of God's people, we expect. Now we know that there are going to be times and things that arise that are simply out of our control. And no one is saying that if you have the flu, you ought to come here. I'm going to tell you right now, don't. If you even think you have like a cold, I'm not going to be upset if you don't. Come sit by me. We're not talking about that. But what we are talking about is making it to be a part of this family. Maybe it would be good for you, but I know it would be good for us because that's who we are. And we love you and want to be a part of this together. Secondly, second expectations. We also expect that you will wear God's name, our family name, both gladly and with reverence, because it means something to call yourself that. Your behavior and your speech when you are here is really important, but that's not my concern. I remember when I was a kid, just a quick story, there was a guy who rode my bus, and he was like the heathen of the heathen on the bus. He was like the first kid who get on. My bus came through the bottom where there were all the farms, and this kid was a country kid, all right? He would sit on the very back seat of the bus, and he always had a can of tobacco. And he just would just use that tobacco there on the back seat of our bus every afternoon. That's just the way it was. I told you I was from Texas. And so if you wanted to use said tobacco, he would be willing to loan you some of said tobacco. But it costs 50 cents now or a dollar later. And if you do not pay 50 cents now or a dollar later, you had to get cut with his pocket knife. That was the rules of the bus. I didn't make them up. I mean, this kid was scary. He's a lot older than me. He's like 4 or 5 years older than me. So he scared me. So imagine my shock when one Sunday I walk into church and said kid and his family are sitting there. was like, this place is going to burn down. But I got to know him a little better. And over the next week, I remember this specific conversation we had in the foyer of our church. That he was trying to tell me something, and I don't even remember what it was, but he caught himself and said, not supposed to cuss in church. I just remember that, because I'd never always thought, like, you know, I was kind of raised by Christian mom, Christian dad. I was like, you better not cuss anywhere. But this kid knew in his mind, you don't cuss in church. Sometimes that's the sort of the idea out there. But we are less concerned about, in fact, if you're going to cuss, I'd rather you do it here, to be honest with you. But your behavior beyond these walls, in your home, at your work, at your school, that when you go and however you act and whatever you say, you represent more than just yourself. You represent the Most High God, and you represent us as well as a part of your family. So what you do and what you say really matters. By the way, I'm not asking you to come up and cuss at me after church. But I want you to know that I love you enough and we have an opportunity to correct it if you're here. But out there in the world, they're just going to make the assumption you're one of them. But you're not. You're not a child of this world. You're a child of God. And because God has made this commitment to bring you into His family, He wants to let you know what that means. And if you need encouragement, if you need forgiveness, if you need help on that walk, God knows we have all stumbled along this path. And if you help riding your steps, we want to lift you up in prayer. Or if you're ready to become a part of this family, come forward this morning. Or won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
Oh, how He loves you and me. Oh, how He loves you and me. He gave His life. What more?